This is Aspen Ideas Health on Aspen Public Radio, our five-part series partnering with the Aspen Ideas Health Conference. All week, we bring you conversations with an exceptional mix of inspiring and provocative experts who dive into topics of global and domestic health.
So what happens when an immune cell sticks to another cell and spends a few minutes stuck to it to decide whether or not it's healthy or diseased?
Sometimes when God closes a door, she also nails all the windows shut.
Rather than trying so hard to be young in perpetuity, we need to be there for those who actually are.
I'm Allison Bektesh. Today, we look inside your body and get familiar with the ongoing drama that is your immune system's constant vigilance against infection and disease. We also look at your body over time. What happens as you age? Is there a way to stay young? And why do we value that so much? And we hear a few more insights about life and loss. Stay with us. Dan Davis is the author of The Beautiful Cure, The Revolution in Immunology, and What It Means for Your Health. He is also the director of research in the Manchester Collaborative Center for Inflammation Research. He's a physicist who converted to biology and is giving us a very up-close look at how the human immune system works.
In my own little world of the sort of part of the system in which I study, when I turned up in an immunology lab, it was clear that immune cells could, for example, kill virus-infected or cancerous cells, and some of how that worked was understood. We knew that there were receptor proteins protruding out of an immune cell that would latch onto a cancer cell, for example, and trigger the process for an immune cell being able to kill a cancer cell. But when I came to the lab, I realized that although we understood that part of the process, we didn't understand much about how that worked over time. So when an immune cell sticks to another cell and it has to decide whether or not that other cell is healthy or diseased, because then if it's diseased, it might kill it, then we didn't understand what happens during that decision-making process. And especially as we know that process takes a few minutes. So what happens when an immune cell sticks to another cell and spends a few minutes stuck to it to decide whether or not it's healthy or diseased? So how things work over in time was what the gap in the knowledge was, if you like. And so coming from physics, I sort of saw that that was a bit of a gap in our understanding, and I used microscopes to watch what happens when immune cells stick to other cells to understand how they would make this decision, whether or not another cell is healthy or diseased, and if it sees a diseased cell, how the immune cell then makes the right kind of immune response. And watching that play out over time allowed us to make various kinds of discoveries. One of the discoveries we made was that we saw that a structure forms at the contact an immune cell makes with another cell. And that structure, that there's a sort of organized patterning of molecules, was similar actually to what was known to happen between neurons. And it led to the idea that an immune cell makes a sort of synapse, like nerve cells make, a synapse between itself and other cells while it decides whether the other cell is healthy or diseased. So that was one of the discoveries I made early on.
At first, even Davis couldn't believe his eyes as he watched this process. It was almost like the individual white blood cell was thinking.
It really is quite a wonderful process. In fact, when I first used a microscope to watch an immune cell sticking onto another cell, I was so shocked with how it looked, how an immune cell, it comes in as a roughly spherical cell, and then it flattens up against the cancer cell, and then various proteins from around the surface of the immune cell move over up to the contact between the two cells, and then the different proteins organize themselves into particular patterns, like a bullseye. You know, there'll be some proteins in the middle, some around that, and then some around that. And the first time or the first, not the first time really, after many times of seeing that, I was still so shocked that that was the right thing that was happening. That what I actually did was I had my girlfriend, who's now my wife, but at the time she was my girlfriend, I had her come into my lab. She wasn't a biologist. And I had her sit with me and kind of do the experiment without really explaining to her too much about what she should see. And then asked her if, you know, what was she seeing? Just to be sure that what I was seeing in these pictures were really what someone else would be seeing. And I wasn't having some kind of biased view that this weird thing was going on. And so sure enough, she saw the similar things I did, and we both agreed this does look like what I thought it was looking like, that there is this very structured interface between the two cells while this decision process is going on.
Inflammation and the immune system have been highly commoditized. There are shelves worth of supplements boasting about giving your immunity a boost. A delicious cornucopia of foods are supposed to help with all of this. Blueberries, chocolate, turmeric. But Davis says the research isn't really there yet. He can watch the intricate process that your white blood cell walls go through when exterminating unwanted microvermin. He describes it as the mesh of a tennis racket expanding to let your army out. But he can't tell you what you specifically need to do to achieve ultra health.
And so I get a lot of questions whenever I talk, give public, you know, talks, and I'll get a lot of questions. And I want to know the answers as much as everyone else. You know, is this particular supplement good for my immune system? Is it right that, you know, would it be better for my immune system if I do this or that activity? You know, everyone has their own. And my message is that it's honestly really hard to know. And so as a scientist, it's not, I don't see it as my role to tell people, you know, what would be good to do. I think you have to dig into the details of what's really known and what's actually just really hard to know, and then make up your own decisions. That I want people to sort of engage with the science and come to their own conclusions about what really would be right for them in their lives, knowing all that we know about how the immune system works, but also knowing where our knowledge is fuzzy.
Hand in hand with staying healthy is the constant resistance to growing old. I mean, the only thing that happens when you're done getting old is that you die. So maybe if we can keep our immune system strong, we can extend our lives here on this planet. But Davis says age is another unknown in the world of immunology.
Most of our understanding is still a bit fuzzy. What we clearly see is that some aspects of our immune system seem to weaken as we age. Our response to vaccines, for example, the same types of vaccines at least that we might be given when we're younger, don't seem to work as well in triggering an appropriate immune response when we're older. But there isn't yet a definitive overarching understanding of why that is. One of the ideas about why that might be is that as we age, then more and more of our immune system has been is geared up to fight off all the different germs that we've experienced during our life. So, for example, you know, if you're infected with a particular flu virus, then some of the cells in your body that fight off that flu virus would stay in your body for a long time, so that if you see the same flu virus again, you'll be quick to respond and kill it off. That means that as you age, quite a lot of your immune system now is devoted to fighting off all the different infections you've previously been exposed to, which might mean that there's less of an ability of your immune system to adapt to entirely new infections that your body hasn't seen before. But really, overall, it's still not entirely clear as to what happens to the immune system as we age. In fact, more broadly than that, it's hard to really pin down what happens to the human body in all different ways as it ages.
To learn more about aging, we turn to Mark Friedman. He's the founder of Encore, a nonprofit that focuses on life after 50. He's also the author of the book How to Live Forever, so he's a good resource for those facing the fear of being an old person. And by chance, I got to talk to him the day before his birthday. May I start the interview by asking how old you yourself are?
I am 60 years old, but tomorrow I will begin my 61st year. So I turn 61 tomorrow.
Gosh, happy birthday. I think birthdays are the most fun thing. Like, out of all holidays that are made up or have obligations, like, birthdays are the thing that I love celebrating. I can't believe I get to talk to you.
Well, you know, it actually relates to this topic because, you know, one of the discoveries in working on the new book was that age consciousness, which is such a big part of American life today and such a central way that we organize society, was completely foreign to people 100 years ago. Birthdays weren't celebrated. People had no idea how old they even were before the 20th century in the United States. The Happy Birthday to You song was invented in 1934 by the greeting card industry. And so we really were oblivious to the whole idea of age before the last century in this country.
It's so fascinating. I would think with that, we were also probably less of a stigma about it then, too. If we weren't actually counting, then we weren't like embarrassed to be old or embarrassed to say how old we were. I remember in my 20s, I had a birthday and an older coworker said, you know, I was excited about it. He said, oh, you're going to stop liking those pretty soon. Like, oh, I was so insulted. Like, I've loved getting older. Why do we have this thing where it's bad to be an older number?
Exactly. In fact, we had more of a sense of the wholeness of life, too, that we all went through these different periods of life, that there was a cycle to life, that was a natural thing. And part of that ethos was reinforced by the institutions of society, the places where we spent our daily lives. People lived in multi-generational households. It was mostly an agrarian economy. So people of different ages worked side by side on the farmstead. Even one-room schoolhouses had 5-year-olds and 40-year-olds learning the alphabet side by side. And so the different ages and stages of life were woven together in daily life. And I think that really contributed. I don't want to go back to some, you know, 19th century utopia, but I think there was some real value to the age mixing that was so much a part of the United States. We were by some estimates, the most age-integrated society in the world 100 years ago, and we finished the 20th century as the most age-segregated. Some people have described it as a state of age apartheid. And that was a really profound reshuffling of society. It included an ethos, like you were suggesting, of that glorified youth and denigrated old age that really came into fruition in the 20th century, but also every major institution of society became deeply age graded. I think out of a sense of efficiency, that it was more efficient to send young people off to schools, and that whole idea really grew out of progressive breakthroughs like universal schooling, child labor laws. Middle people got concentrated in the workplace. And then the advent of Social Security, to my mind, one of the great triumphs of social policy of the last century, though, did lead to older people leaving the workforce by 65 and moving into institutions like retirement communities, senior centers, nursing homes that were very much graded by age. And so the end result is that where people of different ages had mixed regularly in daily life before the 20th century, that stopped happening. The twains stopped meeting. And I think we lost that sense of the wholeness of life.
This is a significant year in the course of our country's life. Mark 2019 as the birthday when the United States of America got old.
2019 is the first year in American history when we've had more people over 60 than under 18. We've become a more old than young society, and that's only going to grow by 2035. We'll have more people over 65 than under 18. That change has produced a lot of concerns about conflict, about scarcity of resources. And I think that there is reason to be concerned about any demographic change of this magnitude. But when you shift the lens from fiscal concerns to emotional truths, the needs and assets of the generations fit together like pieces of a jigsaw puzzle. When I first started working on these issues, I was thinking about supply and demand. You know, there are young people who need more support. There are older people who have time on their hands and big numbers. But now what I know after 3 decades of doing this work is that it goes far beyond efficiency to something that could only be described as humanity. We know that young people need support from caring adults. But what I was unaware of when I first started this journey is that Older people are particularly well suited for this role. Developmental psychologists have shown that as we get older and we realize there are fewer years ahead than behind, our emphasis turns to connection and relationships. And it makes sense. If somebody tells you you've got 4 weeks left to live, you don't go out and start taking oboe lessons. You know, you focus on the people that you care about and zero in on those bonds. But the skills we now know that enable us to be successful at relationship are ones that grow as we get older in a kind of wise way. Emotional regulation, empathy, all blossom later in life.
No offense, old women, but biologically, what are you doing here? Unlike men, there's a cutoff point for female procreation. And if at the Darwinian roots level, all organisms are here to pass on their genes, why live beyond your ability to do that? It turns out there is a biological reason for keeping the old ladies around. In fact, humanity depends on it.
Since the beginning of time, older and younger people have been, you know, an essential part of the life cycle and have supported each other. Evolutionary anthropologists now believe that it was the role of grandmothers in the earliest days of evolution, supporting babies and young children, that is responsible for the long gestational period that separates human babies from all other species and essentially what makes us human. It's called the grandmother hypothesis. And so I think this is such a long-standing part of the human experience, but one we've been in jeopardy of squandering over the last century.
I know. This is all fascinating, but you want to know how to live forever. Well, stay with us. You are listening to Aspen Ideas Health on Aspen Public Radio, exploring our global healthcare system through the research and insights of the speakers of the Aspen Ideas Health Conference, produced by the Aspen Institute. Today, we're exploring the tracks Inflamed and From Lifespan to Healthspan. We have this thing about getting old. We try and put it off. We try and hide it as if not looking old is the same as being young. Our friend Edna Masiwa is on her way to becoming an old woman, so she knows how the older generation is treated. While she sees the resistance in others, she takes pride in the years she's lived.
Aging in terms of getting to 100 years old and so forth. I was speaking to my daughter the other day. She said she doesn't want to age, like go beyond 80, become this very old person. But I think aging should be, those who have aged, the older people, should be respected in any society. We shouldn't really speak against aging, or we shouldn't really go to lengths, because what I'm seeing there are a lot of people who go through a lot of plastic surgery just to address issues of aging, which I don't think should be the case. For me, I believe aging comes with wisdom, and those who are older should be respected in the community. And they also can give advice that can help communities. So aging, for me, it's a positive for me.
She's outlived three of her sisters who died of AIDS. Because of that, her sense of purpose has grown as she is taking on mothering her siblings' children as well as her own.
When I look back and look at the fact that I've aged whilst my siblings passed on at an early age, what I see is I now have a lot of responsibilities, because in as much as the children of my late siblings have grown up, I still have responsibility over them. They come to me. In our culture, I remain their mother. And I think this culture also, which we have in Zimbabwe, is quite rich, because if your mom is to die, you still have your aunt who can attend to whatever needs that could have been provided by your mom. So for me, I really don't feel guilt. Actually, I appreciate that I lived on, because I'm able then to take care of my siblings' children. For example, in December last year, one of the daughters of my siblings got married, and I stood there as the mother. As I look after these children who were left by my sisters, I don't feel like it's a burden. So I really don't have that feeling of guilt. But yes, I remember my siblings. And at times, like there is a wedding, I think of my sibling and wish they were there. But in a good way, not in a way that is depressing.
The intergenerational relationship, that's actually the key to life.
The real fountain of youth is the fountain with youth. You know, I live in a place where Silicon Valley is spending, by some estimates, $45 billion a year in life extension. And I think that rather than trying so hard to be young in perpetuity, we need to be there for those who actually are. That's the only way we're going to make the most of the more old than young society that is our future. But it's also the most powerful route to true happiness, coming to terms with our mortality, accepting it, and recognizing that we're a species that was designed not to to be the future generation, but to leave a legacy of hope and wisdom for all of these younger people who are going to inhabit this future.
Friedman has found the exact social skills we gain as we age are the ones that youth need. Youth do better with adult support. The old do better when they turn to purpose. We have at our fingertips a symbiotic relationship that is the magic equation for eternal life. The only way to stay alive forever is to stay alive after you die. When you talk to someone about their mentor, who has since passed, you'll see resurrection before your eyes. But we can't just talk about mentorship as a rosy thing. We need to actually be there for the next generation. Crystal Hall, associate professor at the Evans School of Public Policy and Governance at the University of Washington, says these teaching relationships bring us full circle, addressing many of the issues of diversity and access that we've heard about throughout this series. She says the effort needs to be intentional.
I think it's very easy for people to essentially pass the buck on these things. And I think it's really important. I think about this a lot in my capacity as a mentor, for example. I think it's important for individuals to recognize the extent to which they are gatekeepers for these types of things, and the extent to which, you know, many different individuals can play a role in supporting these processes in the long term. And so for me, as a woman of color, I'm sure in some ways it's easier for me to really recognize the opportunities that I have to mentor folks and to encourage folks to stay on this path. At the same time, I think it's important for others to do that as well and to recognize the role that we play. And I talk about this with my master's students, for example. I teach students who are going to go on to work in the public and the nonprofit sector, and I talk to them about recognizing the power that you have, because I think it can be really easy for us to think about the power that we don't have and not recognizing the role that we all can play in ensuring that there are pipelines to creating representation at all levels.
Knowing your spirit will live on is all well and good, but it's still a bummer to know it's all going to end for you. And a much bigger horror when it all ends for someone you love. What comes with aging is loss, and we just aren't good at that. We just aren't good at grief. We're going to end on a sad note, which maybe is okay. Culturally, we try to hide grief and crying, but is that necessary or healthy?
God, I don't know. I love a good cry, frankly. I think it's just like a bath for your eyeballs. It's like taking a hot shower for your feelings.
Nora McInerney hosts the podcast Terrible, Thanks for Asking. She's got the whole tragic loss thing down. As she tells it, a couple of years ago, she had a miscarriage just before her dad died of cancer and her husband succumbed to a brain tumor. The husband thing wasn't exactly a surprise. His name's Aaron. They had just moved in together as boyfriend and girlfriend when he had an unexpected seizure and was rushed to the hospital. They knew it was bad, but it was important not to put an emphasis on the closing date, so to speak. In the time that Aaron was sick, they even got married and had a child. They didn't even glance at the hourglass.
We told the doctor as soon as he said it was stage 4 glioblastoma, we said, we never want to hear how much time. We're not interested in that. In that information. We'll do whatever you tell us to do. And we can talk about that. But we're not here to be told, like, you have 3 years to live or you have 5 years to live. That just doesn't feel like helpful information. So we didn't know, but we knew.
Death is permanent. So there's no comfort phrase to offer someone who experienced loss on that level. Keep your chin up or it gets better are pretty shallow reassurances. Even when it's not that dramatic level of loss, is it actually helpful to hear your friend say, you should just move on from a breakup, or good thing you went through that hard time in your life. Now you're so much stronger.
That's a barf sound that I just made, because that's what that phrase makes me want to do. There are a couple phrases that I hate. Moving on. Making lemonade out of lemons, finding the silver lining. What doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Sometimes what doesn't kill you just maims you. sometimes when God closes a door, she also nails all the windows shut. So it's sort of a way of forcing a silver lining onto people and really rushing them through grief. And I think that just comes from people not knowing that grief is more than just crying. And the minute that they see you just, you know, participating in the world, they assume that it's over, or they are so uncomfortable with your discomfort, they just want you to be okay so they can stop worrying about you.
Sometimes when someone asks you how you're doing, the answer isn't fine, and you don't have to say fine.
So I did not tell my siblings, my mother, who are really the core of my entire life, I didn't tell them the truth. I didn't tell them the truth. I didn't know how to need them or how to accept help. I didn't know what kind of help I needed or how to ask for it. And I wish I would have just said what I just said to you, that I don't know. I don't know what I need. I just know I'm not okay. But instead, when they checked in with me, I was like, things are good. Things are fine. Things are fine. And I said it enough that they believed me. It's isolating. Every time we lie to the people who really want to know the truth, we're just building this lonely little prison for ourselves.
After all, our whole mission for health and healthcare and health access, what we're after is life and connections. So the best thing we can do is embrace that for all the good and bad it brings and hold tight those we hold dear.
And the best thing that we can do for each other is to acknowledge that something hard just happened to you. And now your life is different. And now you are different. And you are also not done changing. So it will not feel today how it feels in 5 years, but you will always have it with you. The same way that the best things in your life, those memories that you want to keep forever, are always a part of you. We are the sum of our experiences, the good ones and the bad ones. Those are not the exception to life. Those are also a part of life. We need to be more comfortable with other people's discomfort and their suffering, because someday it'll be our suffering. And we will want people who can just sit in it with us.
You've been listening to Aspen Ideas Health on Aspen Public Radio in partnership with the Aspen Ideas Health Conference, produced by the Aspen Institute, June 20th through June 23rd. I'm Allison Bechtesh. Thanks for listening. To your health.